So welcome, everyone. It's wonderful to be back at the JCC for our next installment of Coffee, Cake, and Learning. Little shout out to the wonderful Jane Austen, Sense and Sensibility, one of our all-time favorite adaptations. If you haven't seen it, this is the one with Emma Thompson and Katie Winslet. Great movie. So Sense and Sensibilities. And so just to give you a little thematic preview, the idea of the title and the connection of the title is that this week's Torah reading is officially the end of the narrative, of the fun story. So when you're teaching Bible, Torah, to children, this is where it becomes a challenge. Because up till now, every single segment, you know, Genesis, Noah, the flood, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, the brothers, Moses, Exodus, Yul Brynner, Sinai last week we had, you know, the giving of the Torah. So now we're finally up to what is written in the Torah. And it's kind of like for teachers, we used to joke, it's the end of the fun. So the children got to get down and kind of get into the minutia of the laws. So what we're going to discover today, hopefully, is that the Torah is divided. It can be divided into different types of segments, if you will, of commandments. But there are two main different style commandments. One is what's called a mishpat, which happens to be the name of our parsha this week, the mishpatim, which could be translated as ordinances. There's lots of different ways of translating. Essentially, a mishpat is defined by the rabbis as a law, a rule, a mitzvah, a precept, with sense and sensibility. That a human being has the ability to analyze it, and it speaks to you because it makes sense. And then we're going to touch on, a little later, the second segment of commandments, and they are decrees, statutes. They're called chukim. And they're much more mysterious because, as we're going to learn today, they don't really have accessible meaning behind it. And sometimes even the command itself is so mysterious, or it's even contradictory, and it just doesn't speak to the normal human being. And I'll illustrate that with a great one, because you're going to all say, what? Milk and meat, kosher. Now you might say, well, but Rabbi, I remember hearing, you know, that there are health benefits to not eating such and such a fit, you know, shellfish could cause this if it's not eaten, you know, cooked correctly. And, you know, there are issues with cooking pork correctly that could have issues. Okay, but that is not connected at all to the reasoning that God ordained kosher laws. So again, we'll discuss that in short order. So let's begin with the first verse of our Torah reading this week. Remember, each week we have what's called the Parsha HaShavua, the weekly reading. We divide up the parts of the Torah, the five books of Moses, into segments. Usually they're between 80 and about 150 psukim verses. So this week is Mishpatim, and it's just basically replete, filled up with different types of laws. So this is the first verse. I'll read it in Hebrew for those who are into foreign languages. This is God's words. Ve'ela ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. Number one. And these are the laws that you shall set, you Moses, lowercase y, that you Moses shall set before them. These are the laws. So then I'll just paraphrase what Rashi here is saying. It's a very nice concept. It's important. There is a letter vav at the beginning of that first word of our parsha. And vav in Hebrew, it's the sixth letter of the alphabet. It means and. And it's very often referred to as the vav hachibur, which means a connector. It's the connecting vav. And the purpose of that vav, the and, is to connect what could be disparate subject matters, or just cementing the idea that there's an interrelationship between different sections. So last week, we got the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot. We were given the 10 sayings or commandments at Mount Sinai. And the vav here, that first letter and in our very first word of our new segment, it connects last week's Sinaitic gift of the Torah to all the laws that are in this week's segment. In the same way that last week was given at Sinai, so too were the different laws of this week given at Mount Sinai. Because there were different times in the Jewish sojourn in the wilderness, not all the 613 biblical commandments were all given at Sinai. That's clear. How many? It's a debate. The rabbis like to argue about it. However, the laws of the Mishpatim, these laws that are the sense and sensibility laws that we refer to, they were given at Mount Sinai. Interesting. Now, let's discuss what it means to have a law that has sense and sensibility, okay? So the first series of laws is not going to relate to any of us here today. Thank God. It might have related in a very profound way before Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. The laws are the laws of slavery, of a Jewish slave. Now, why that would be so powerful and profound, think of the timing. Jewish people get to Mount Sinai. What were they just a couple months earlier? They were slaves to Pharaoh. So to compare and contrast the Jewish view of slavery and the import that we place on the slave's life, that if a person falls low on their luck and they're sold into slavery, a Jewish person could sell themselves because of debt or because of circumstance for a series of 6 years. And then if they really want to stay there because they feel security, they could even stay longer, okay? But again, the Jewish point of view on the slave and the Pharaoh Yul Brynner view of slavery, they're not even in the same realm. A Jewish slave gets kavod, it gets honor and respect. So much so that if, let's say, you had two mattresses, two beautiful beds to sleep on. It was just you and your slave, okay? You have a beautiful $4,000 sleep comfort, one of those sleep comfort number Tempur-Pedic beds, yeah? And then you got the pull-out couch, which, you know, which has anyone who sleeps there gets a visit to the chiropractor on Monday. It's one of those couches, okay? You may not say, well, I'm the master, I'm the Adon, and he or she is the slave. No, the slave gets first choice. Amazing. If you're having dinner together, and you have a hamburger, and you have a beautiful ribeye steak, guess who gets the first choice for the ribeye? The slave, not you. In fact, the Torah and the Talmud says that anyone, kolakona eva, anybody, the Talmud says in Kedushim, anybody who purchases a slave, it's like they actually bought themselves a master, because you have to have paramount focus on how you treat the slave. So you can imagine for a moment, the Jewish people are incredibly sensitive to what the Torah speaks about in terms of slavery, because that is the real, clear and present experience for them. So to hear in these opening words about the contrast of Jewish slavery and how we love you, how we have an approach, it would be incredibly meaningful to every Jew there who would experience the lashes of Pharaoh's taskmasters. So again, wow, you can imagine how moved they were by the new laws of the Torah and how that really spoke to them. So you talk about speaking to somebody, how a commandment, oh, it speaks to me, I really get it. They really got those first series of rules. So it's very unusual that they would open with, you know, the laws of slavery, but I think we see now how profound it was. So every rule that is the Mishpatim is something that you say, you know what, if the Torah didn't ordain that, if God did not say at Sinai, thou shall not steal or thou shall not murder, you know, I could have figured this one out on my own. Because what society could possibly exist without such rules? The only place I know where it's okay to steal up to $1,000 is in San Francisco. I mean, that really is true, by the way. If you do shoplifting up to $999, apparently they just release you with no bail and you don't even get a criminal record. So I'm not making that up. So other than that, and other than maybe Sodom and Gomorrah, most societies are sort of predicated upon personal property rights, because otherwise you would have anarchy. Not a good thing. So again, if God didn't ordain some of these rules, you'd say, you know what? A functional society, we would have to have certain property rights, certain rights that are given to the human beings. I'll give you another couple beautiful ones. The Talmud says, what if God didn't say that women especially have to be modest. In other words, the beautiful ladies of our lives should dress in a way, we call it sneas, to be modest, to not show the beauty off except to your husband, right? Or your boyfriend. That's okay. Or a girlfriend. That's fine. But that's called sneas. So you know what the Talmud says? What if God didn't give that rule? Like, what if it wasn't part of the lexicon of Judaism? We could have looked at the pussycat and learned the rule. Because let's be honest, I love dogs. Okay, I love dogs. But dogs have no shame. Dogs publicly do their business. And they don't, I have never seen a dog, you know, like look at you like with embarrassment. Oh my gosh. Gonna excuse me, I gotta go to the outhouse back here. Could you just give me a minute, you know? No, they're public. There's no shame. A cat? I've never owned a cat, but if you are cat owners, they slink off into the night. And they have their little cat place, and they do whatever they do, and they even cover it up after out of shame. And they come back, you say, hey, Garfield, where were you? And he's like, ordering lasagna. I wasn't doing anything wrong. I stepped out of the room to order some pizzas and lasagna. What do you mean? Bathroom? What? Right? So if you didn't say you should have certain modesty in terms of beauty and other things, we could have extrapolated that from nature itself, which of course is God, but still, it's great. Or another one, what about fidelity? Fidelity in marriage, etc. Well, we could have extrapolated it from the marvelous union of a Yonah. Because when doves mate, they mate for life. They mate for life. So we talk about fidelity. Wow. Yeah. So again, we didn't have to know about honor and respect in marriage and fidelity to relationships. We could have looked at nature and said, oh my gosh, if the doves have this attitude and they're just doves, how much more so it must apply to a human being. So again, how much more accessible could a law be than if it's visible to us in nature in the lower creatures of our world? Right? So again, this is sense and sensibility. So this is what we're saying. There are certain types of mitzvot, of precepts, that we can taste within the command a reason. Now, I have to be cautious here, because it's not the real reason. The real reason is kind of unknowable, because we're people, right? But we even say the reason for a mitzvah, you know what we call it? It's very beautiful. We say tameh ha-mitzvah, the reason behind what you do a command. But the word tam doesn't just mean reason, it means taste. That you can taste within the commandment a little bit of the divine and say, oh my gosh, wow, this makes sense. Now, how does that help us? Because it's an encouragement, right? If you say to me, do X, Y, and Z, and it is like rocket science, and I don't understand because I'm not a rocket scientist, then it takes absolute 100% blind faith, if you will, and emunah, just to say I'm in even though I don't get any of it. But if you yourself taste the reason behind it and you say, oh wow, you know, this makes sense, this speaks to me, then that motivates one, you would hope, right, to keep the laws better. So that is what our parsha, this is what our section of rules are. They're slavery for the former slaves. They're the rules that we could see in nature. They're rules that a society needs, and every society hopefully has enacted, because they speak to a person. So again, just as a word of caution, God allows us access to make it easier for us. I mean, that's clear. In other words, it's not the only reason that I do X, Y, or Z, because I, as a human being, can taste it. I'm not God. So only God has the grand design. But by allowing us a little snippet of access, if you will, to the rule, why it might work and why it might be necessary, it encourages me, and maybe I'll give a pass on the other ones, right? So there, in other words, if I'm looking at a smorgasbord of rules, right? You ever go to a smorgasbord or the entree to the dinner. Like, so if you go to a Jewish wedding, they always have a very lavish, or hopefully lavish, smorg. You come early, because the smorg is usually better than the dinner. I promise you. In fact, it's very, very funny. when my wife and I were married in Brooklyn. So we went with my father-in-law, my late father-in-law, my mother-in-law. My parents weren't able to be there in person. They were on the phone. And we were like, you know, dickering, if you will, with the wedding hall guy at this very religious wedding hall in Brooklyn called, I think it was called the Eden Palace. Still around, very big place. And they do lavish s'mores. I heard about it, but I was fasting that day because the day of our wedding we fast. I didn't get the s'more. I heard legend of it after. They brought food to us after, like when my wife and I had got married, you're secluded in what's called yichud, so you get some food. But I didn't get the bratwurst. Nobody brought me, you know, the food that I heard about. In fact, they served bratwurst to the point where I had a guy who used to not eat kosher, and he swore to me, he said, Rabbi Kaplan, I know you got married in Brooklyn. I get it. And I know the wedding hall is like glatt kosher. I get it. He said, but the bratwurst you served at your wedding, they were not made out of beef. They were something else. Now, that was a joke because at the time, you know, he knew the flavor. He had been to Milwaukee, I guess, and seen a Brewers game and had a bratwurst. I guess traditional bratwurst is made from the other white meat, right? So he always teased me about my wedding. Anyways, so when we were dickering with the wedding hall guy about the costs involved, see, he joked us. He says, look, I'm going to throw in the bar for free. The bar's on us, complimentary bar. And then I looked at him, I said, well, that's nice. How about the smorg? Would you throw that in? So he's a religious guy. He looks at us. He says, no. So I said, what do you mean? He said, look, if this was an Irish wedding, please, if anyone's Irish here, don't take this personally. Okay? He says, if this was an Irish wedding, the smorg would be free and the bar would cost you. He says, but the Jews are not so much into the adult beverages, but they're into the s'more. We charge you arm and a leg for the s'more. I never forgot. That was a very funny line. Isn't that a funny line? He said, the Irish would have a free smorgasbord, you know? He knew his business, right? So please, I hope I didn't offend anybody. It wasn't intentional. So let's say that Judaism and the Torah specifically is like a smorg. So our attitude in a utopian universe should be, oh, well, I'm going to have all the items on the smorg in limitation so I don't blast through my waist size, but I will prioritize certain items and they will motivate me to even try some of the items on the menu that I might not really be that interested in. But because I love the delicious caterer was so wonderful that it encourages me to try even a little bit of the other items. That's sort of maybe a metaphor, if you will, for the idea of a mishpat, a law that speaks with sense and sensibility. But I promised you to talk about the other group of laws, the mysterious decrees. So Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, quotes the following. What is a chok? What is this decree from God? It is a decree from a king. So you go to the king, a despot, and the despot says, so shall it be written, so shall it be done. So at that point, you don't put up your hand in the back of the court of the king unless you are not a fan of having your head attached to your body. And you don't question the king's authority. You say, yes, your royal highness, thank you. And then you can grumble after you walk out of earshot. You don't grumble in the presence of the king. So that's the concept of a group of rules that are chukim. We keep the rules because God says, I know better than you. I can't explain it to you. But if you love me and you want a covenant with me, a bris, you got to buy into everything. So some are going to speak to you, but just because they speak to you, don't eliminate the others that don't speak to you. Just trust me, God says, that I love you. I want this relationship and they are all good for you. So again, it's a magnificent idea because think about it. If I'm motivated by the little 5-10% of the laws that speak to me and I understand part of it is, oh my gosh, that's reasonable and sensible, then the fact that all of them, in a sense, are equally mysterious, I don't think about that because that's the truth. Every rule of the Torah, like we said at the outset, is equally mysterious. We don't really know the full import and impact that any command could have. Only God has that in his world, but not us. How do I know this? Let's look at the next source, Source 3. So this comes to us in the book of Numbers. There's actually a parsha called Chukat, Chukas. That's the mysterious decree from a king. Here is what it says. This is the statute, Zot Chukat HaTorah, of the Torah, which the Lord commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel and have them take for you a perfectly red, unblemished cow upon which no yoke was laid. Numbers 19 and 2. So what is that? This rule specifically speaks of something called the red heifer. And the red heifer, we'll speak about this in a moment, is the quintessential mysterious law that is beyond any human comprehension. Now, how do I know this? Because the wisest human being that we know of was a man named Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. And King Solomon, I quote, I spent many hours, I spent many days, I spent many years trying to understand the wisdom, the chokhmah, the insight and the motivation behind the mysterious red heifer, and I came up short. I'm lacking. It's beyond me. So again, no insult to anyone here, but I promise you, if it's beyond King Solomon, it's beyond your pay grade and my pay grade, for sure, okay? So it is paradigmatic of a rule that we do, that we observe. Now, we don't do it today because we don't have a temple, so it's not really germane to our life. So what is the rule? That there was a pure cow, and it didn't have to actually be red, but the color had to be uniform, and it was born once every few generations. And they used that cow and the ashes specifically of that cow to bring back a human being, a Jew, man or woman, who had come in contact with something that defiled them, spiritual defilement. We're talking, if the word is tameh. So if a person came in contact with the dead, for example, let's say they were under a roof, under an ohel, and there was someone who was deceased, they could, either in close proximity or otherwise, become tameh. So for example, today, kohanim, priests, even if they are considered tameh, because everyone is under the category of being sort of ritually impure, because we don't have a red heifer, we don't have a temple. But, like I know in Israel, the hospitals, I don't know if it still applies, but I remember hearing stories about this, they would actually warn people in the hospital, if there was someone who was imminently in danger of dying, they would actually tell the priests, the kohanim, there would be like an alert in Israel, you need to leave the hospital because there could be a death and you don't want to be in the same building as someone who is dead. So again, it's an interesting rule. So we don't know the rhyme or reason. The whole idea of your soul, your neshama somehow, becoming ritually unclean, I mean, what does that even mean? I don't know. I can't explain really what it means. Because obviously it's not physical, it's in the spiritual realm. And the idea that you have this red heifer, why a young red cow that had never been worked, and then you take the ashes of it. And here's the crazy thing. The priest who carries the ashes, so they're ashes that you're going to mix in what they call mayim chayim, spring water, water that is a spring source, live water. So the priest who carries the ashes, because they're the ashes of a dead animal, it contaminates him. But when you mix the ashes with the spring water and make the formula, boom, then it relieves said impurity. So you're looking and you're thinking, wait a minute. Now, again, I know scientifically and in chemistry, you could probably come up with if I have an acid, before I dilute the acid, it might be injurious, but when I dilute, right? Okay, you can come up with a reason, I'm sure. But it doesn't really make sense that if I have the actual remedy and I'm touching the remedy, how it makes me unclean until I mix the remedy with water and then I dilute it, all of a sudden then it's okay. So it's literally an oxymoron of the highest level. It's contradictory. It makes no sense whatsoever. And it's not made to make sense. And it defines the essence of the Torah, because look at the first words, the first three words in Hebrew, in English, it's the first six, seven words of that number three, but in Hebrew it's just three words. Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the statute of the Torah. Stop. All the Torah, in other words, one would say, is a chok, is a statute. Oh, but wait a minute, you just said that there's different types and categories. Yes, but at the end of the day, all of them are a mystery, like we said, and this is the proof, that all of them defy logic. It's just that humans can sense in sensibility certain ones that speak to you. But that's not really, as we said, the reason any law was given. It's kind of unknowable. So it's a beautiful concept. So you have these two categories, then, just to back up here. You have a category of laws that are unknowable, the decrees, and then you have the statutes, and then you have these laws that are sense and sensibility, the laws that we talked about in our section, in our Parsha Mishpatim, and perhaps they help someone, encourage somebody to keep the other. So all of it is a mixture. So at the end of the day, what does God want? God does not want you to treat his Torah like a shmorg. He doesn't want you to pick and choose, because a person might pick and choose based on many different possibilities. Like, one might be how I connect to that. I'll say, well, you know what? This speaks to me, so I will keep that rule. And not the other 50 or 60. I don't get them, and I'm not in. I'm not in for those. But that, yeah, I'm good at that one. There are people who do this. Or it could be that maybe one picks and chooses because one thinks it's important. They'll say, well, you know what? Obviously, if it made the list of the Ten Commandments, it's big. So I'll keep the Ten Commandments, yeah. But the other stuff, you know, how much reward could it be? In other words, the Ten Commandments, each time you do one of those Ten Commandments, or don't do one of those Ten Commandments, right? In other words, if it's a negative command, the way you get a reward is when you're enticed to do it and you refrain. Obviously, I get massive brownie points in my heaven bank account. How do you know? So in fact, it's a beautiful concept that there was a king who had an orchard. And he did not tell his workers which plantings paid more than the other plantings. So some of the plantings were extremely valuable and some less so. What was the fear? The fear was that his workers, if they knew the value of each planting, what would they do? They would only plant the more valuable crops, and the crops that didn't pay as well, they would ignore. And then, well, what would happen to the king's magical field? It would be bereft. It would die because it wouldn't be taken care of. That metaphor is what it means to be a member of the Jewish people. That the orchard is all of the Torah, is all of Judaism, is all of our relationship with God. And we dare not trample and leave unseeded and unplanted and uncared for any part, because attitudinally, it's showing a disrespect to God and disrespect to the Torah. Does that make sense? Okay. So let's now talk about the difference between the Jewish people and the nations of the world. And I think I quoted this to you, but I'm going to quote it again. This is a metaphorical, not a literal Talmudic story, okay? Before God gave the Torah at Mount Sinai to the Jewish people, I think we spoke about this in one of my classes, so you'll forgive me. He first came to all the 70 primary nations of the world. There were 70 primary languages after the Tower of Babylon. There were 70 original nations, the Shivim Umos. Okay. And he came to each nation and he said first, do you want to be Israel? And they were all excited. Do I want to be Israel? Yeah, of course I want to be Israel. God said, okay. So the major component of Israel and our relationship is that you keep my Torah. Now the Torah had not been given yet. This is before Mount Sinai. So the Torah existed in heaven with God, whatever that means. So then the Talmud illustrates three nations specifically. First, you had Esau. Now Esau, twin brother of Jacob, Yaakov, he desperately wanted those blessings, remember? He wanted to murder Jacob when he found out that Jacob had taken the blessings from Isaac, their father, had dressed up, you know, it's a famous story. Okay, so they offered Esau's children, the Edomites, could be the nation of Rome, because they say that Rome descends from Edom. And they said to the nation of the Edomites, do you want to be my people? And Edom said, yeah. Then you got to keep my Torah. Are you in? And you know what Edom, you know what the Romans said? What's written in this Torah of yours? Ma katuba. So God looks at Esav, you know, Edom. He thinks, what's written in the Torah? So in other words, when you go on Amazon, sometimes they have what's called a sample chapter. So before you buy a book, you can click on the sample chapter and you can read, like, and it's good, it's helpful, because maybe it's not written in third person and you only like third person novels and not first person, right? So it's interesting to read a little bit of a couple chapters. So they want a sample chapter. So they said to God, which is not what God wanted to hear, clearly, what's written in this Torah of yours? Because if I'm signing my life over, I have a right to know before I sign on the dotted line. It's a legal document. So again, you can excuse them for asking, kind of. So God said, oh, you want to know what's in it? Really, Edomites? It says, thou shalt not murder. That's my sample chapter, my sample mitzvah commandment. So Esau blanched. Thou shalt not murder. Did you understand that we have red hair? And that red hair symbolizes the murder that is genetically implanted in us. It's a violence that we have that's hard to control. I'm sorry, but we define ourselves by murder. And if this is an example of what the Torah is about, we take a pass. And then he went to the Moabites, Moab, descendants of Lot. And again, do you want my Torah? Do you want to be in with me as Jewish people? He said, yeah, but what's written in the Torah? Give me a sample chapter. So God said, really? You want a sample? Okay. Don't commit adultery. Whoa, said the Moabites. God, do you understand that my name means from father? That my great-grandfather Lot actually was drunk and had incestuous relationship with his daughters, and that's where we come from? This is who we are. I'm sorry, but not for us. And then he went to the Ishmaelim, the Ishmaelites, the oldest firstborn son of Abraham. And again, do you want to be Israel? Yes. Then you have to keep my Torah. What's written in the Torah? Ishmaelites are waiting. God says you can't steal. Can't steal? You understand that it says in the Torah that Yad Bakol Bakol, right? That my hands are in everything. There's a reason Saudi Arabia, you know, chop off thieves' hands. I guess it's a systemic issue. So they said, we take a pass on this one, pal. Sorry, we don't want it. And then he went through every nation. And then finally, who did he come to last? Us. He said, Jews. Do you want to be Israel? We said, we're in. So God's waiting for the next. He says, do you want the sample chapter of the Torah? No. No? Really? No, not interested. You're going to accept and sign away your Torah rights, and you're not even interested in seeing a sample. No. What would it matter to me? We love you, God. We want to be part of this relationship. What would it matter what's written in the Torah? Nasa v'nishma. We're in, we'll do it, and we'll hear the details tomorrow in the future. We're in. God said, right answer. And that's when we became the Jewish people. Now, you might say, well, why do we need this whole metaphor? Because clearly, if the nations of the world never had an opportunity to be Israel, they could always say, when we mess up, and we have messed up historically, my gosh, if you gave us the chance, we would be better at Israel than Israel is. Look at the Jews, right? And then God will say, but you had your chance. Y'all wanted the sample chapters, and you just qualified yourselves. So shut up. You're not in the game anymore. Okay. So now we understand that the nature of the covenant is all about my love for God and God's love for me. So what would it matter what a rule is or what it says to do or do not? Because I'm in. I said, Nasa v'nishma. Now, what brought me to that level? Look at source 5. They, the children of Israel, said to God as a response, do you want my Torah? All that the Lord spoke, we will do and we will hear later. And that's from this week's Parsha. So in other words, the sense and sensibility rules enabled the Jewish people to really buy into the Sinaitic Torah experience because they could taste within the rules, the mitzvot, why God would ordain such mitzvot. So therefore it helped to encourage them. But what is even a higher level that we discovered is at the end of the day, there really aren't any reasons that are... I mean, it's nice that humans have human sensibility, but at the end of the day, does it really matter? No. And I am willing to jump in and say kawabunga. And by the way, this was Snoopy, not Michelangelo from the Ninja Turtles. Snoopy said this first back in the 1950s. I researched it because I said kawabunga to somebody. He said, you're quoting Michelangelo? I said, no, I'm quoting Snoopy from Peanuts. It was Snoopy. I looked it up.
Chief Thunder Thud said it before him.
Before him? Yes. He said kawabunga? Yes. And he was in Little Abner?
He was in Howdy Doody.
Wow, and that was before Snoopy.
Yes.
Oh my God, did you hear this? Yes. So you have Michelangelo, Snoopy, and Chief...
Chief Thunder Thud.
Thunder Thud. All right, I learned something new. I love it. Kawabunga. So kawabunga means I'm in. I'm in for the ride. We're in for the ride. Okay. So I think we now have a much clearer understanding of the nature of the covenant. It's like the majestic Ruth said to Naomi. Naomi tried to convince Ruth, don't convert, don't become Jewish. We had a class. And Ruth basically said, I'm in. Oh, do you want to hear about the rules? No. Oh, but the rule says you can't do this and this. Doesn't matter. I'm in. And she started listing a whole bunch of rules trying to dissuade Ruth from converting, becoming Jewish. And you know what Ruth's response to each and every potential hiccup was? I don't care. Does it really matter? I'm in. I want to be part of the Jewish people, and I'm in forever. Yeah? And if you won't take me, Naomi, I'm still in. It doesn't matter. I love you, Naomi, and I want you to be the one who brings me to Judaism, but if you won't do it, I'm still coming. You cannot dissuade me. And at that point, when Naomi saw that Ruth was becoming more powerful in her affirmation of what she wanted, and that the details didn't matter to Ruth. In other words, think about it. What would it matter? If you have a relationship with someone who loves you and you love them, do the real little details... In other words, I'll give an example as a guy, okay? So you bring a guy a shidduch, okay? A marriage. And there's a couple things, a prospect. There's a couple things he finds out about the young lady. And then you say, you know, he's falling in love, and you say, oh, by the way, you know, she's a lousy cook. Any guy that breaks off a marriage because of that is the world's biggest fool. He's a buffoon. What would it matter? Does it really matter? I'm in love. It's a relationship. The fact that she can't cook. She snores at night. Is this an issue? I have earplugs. Whatever. You're telling me nonsense. In other words, I'm in love. I am, Bambi, Twitter-pated. And I want this relationship for the rest of my life. This is my Azer Kenegdi. This is my opposite that I've lived and waited for all my life. And you're telling me a little detail? Like, this is garbage. I'm not interested. This is our attitude at Mount Sinai. Right? When God said, do you want to know the details? We said, absolutely not. It's irrelevant. It just matters not. I am in. Okay. So let's end with the following concept, and we'll be very brief. What does the decree of the Bible, of the Torah, come to address? That red heifer. So we spoke about the red heifer. If a person became defiled by death. So I really believe that that is why it's inaccessible to King Solomon. It's inaccessible to everyone. Even Moshe. Moses was the greatest person ever. And he wanted to know about the mystery of death. Love for you. Why do bad things happen to good people? I want to know the mystery of life and death. And of course, it's unknowable. That's the whole point. That because the red heifer came to specifically address ritual impurity as a result of touching something dead, whether it be a rodent or a human being, that contact is unknowable. So the fact that the remedy is unknowable makes a whole lot of sense, right? Two unknowables is knowable. Sorry, couldn't resist that one. So here is my point. Life itself is unknowable, but we have just discovered that life's just about relationships between ourselves and God and between ourselves and ourselves. There isn't anything else that's meaningful. And you know what? This is going to come as a little shock. Death itself is actually a blessing that brings purpose and meaning to life. Think about it for a moment, okay? If we lived for eternity, there have been a lot of movies about eternal people. They're not happy people because every time they love, the love dies and they live and they keep burying and seeing get old the people in their lives. There have been tons of movies and mythos based on the idea of eternity and how miserable it would be to live forever. So we live in what's called an entropic universe. I love that word. Entropy means things die. They don't live forever. But it's the entropy, the fact that we live in an entropic universe that gives the magic and meaning to life. Because think about it for a moment. Let's say you're experiencing a singular moment in your life and you look around you and you say, holy smokes, wow. This is a singular moment. Wow. And then somebody, if you live forever, would say, no, actually, it's not meaningful. What do you mean? What do you mean, George? George would say, well, we're eternal, right? Yeah. So if we go on for eternity, the atoms, the molecules, will realign themselves, and this moment will recreate itself if you live long enough. And since living long enough is not an issue because I'm eternal, this is not a momentous occasion because the moment will be recreated over and over and over again. So eternity sucks the meaning and purpose away from the things that are meaningful to us in this life. So the fact that we don't live forever actually gives meaning and purpose to everything we do, because each opportunity that we have, each relationship that we have, is not eternal. It cannot be recreated. It is a singular, momentous occasion. And so this is the nature of what Torah is. So in other words, that the greatest mystery that God gave us is this entropic universe where death is going to get everyone at some point. It's okay, because it also bestows and gifts us the gift of time. And think about it. What is the greatest mechitza? What is the most unassailable point that you can never cross backwards to? In other words, space and time. Space, I can go back. If I leave that, if I just walk out for a second, I forget my hat, I can just poke myself back into that room, and at least spatially, I'm where I was one moment ago. But you can't even go back 1 second in time to recreate the past. It is the most final mechitza. It breaches. You can't breach that. It's unbreachable. And so therefore, that's why it's such a gift. In other words, our class today was never and will never be again. We could assemble all of us together anytime in the future, but it can't possibly be the same class. It's not the Yahrzeit date for your late mother, and it's not this. Everyone here is different today, and you'll be different in 1 minute, right? So that is the beauty of life. So yes, it's a mystery. And yes, maybe we want to have a little more information, maybe. But I think the goal, the takeout is, what a magnificent gift we have. That we have this relationship with God, the relationship with our fellow human beings. That we have a Torah, a playbook through which to go forward. And yes, we can even sense some of the reason, the sense of sensibilities in certain things that we do, just to motivate ourselves to do better and to rise higher and higher and higher. And at the end of the day, nobody wants to leave this world. But when we do understand that no one lives for eternity, it also imbues kiddushah, holiness, uniqueness into each person, each relationship, and to our lives together. I wish everyone a wonderful day.